Hello, my name is Lori Gooding. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
I'm Lori.
Whew, okay. I hate doing this. I'm just going to tell you, I hate it. It's never been one of my favorite things to do, and it's still not. And I'm so glad that they have these big screens up here to ease my mind. That helps. I want to thank Harlan and Zan for asking me to speak and having me and my husband come. And I want to thank my husband for coming with me. He is absolutely my favorite person on earth. He is just my best friend, and I just love him to death. And he comes and supports me whenever I speak. I come and support him whenever he speaks, by the way, which will be next year at this conference. So y'all come back. Glad you're here. You can hear the truth today. You can hear him next year. I also want to thank anybody that had anything to do with putting on this conference. It is a lot of work to put on a conference. I know that. I've been involved in conferences. And, you know, you guys, I can tell you, you guys do a good job because it seems like it was really easy, and we all know that it's not. So thank you. Give them a round of applause. I'm going to put this down here. We've had some great speakers. Eileen kicked us off. She was great. We had some commonality. Her mom and dad were Harry and Harriet. My mom and dad were Harry and Mary. Her dad was in World War II. My daddy was in World War II. She had a threesome. I had a three-way call with somebody one time. Then we had Charlie. I like hearing Charlie. I mean, he's in the book, and he does a good job. I've heard him a couple of times. He does a really good job. He came up to me afterwards. He goes, "I am so sorry. I did not mention you. I feel so bad. I am so sorry." I go, "Don't worry about it. You're probably thinking about yourself. It's okay." Whew. And then we had our little Al-Anon partner over here from Texas. Did a great job. And listen, not to slight the other speakers, but Matthew, one of the best AA talks I've ever heard, honestly. Absolutely fabulous, honestly. And then there was Katie this morning. God, if we could just get her out of her shell. She's about to beat that shyness, I think. Katie's great. She was talking, you know, and I was just thinking about what she was saying. What did you say that you, what was it that you were saying about you take control? What was that called? Was that called when you were?
Driven.
No, that was not it.
In charge.
We call that control, honey, in my program. Just saying. That's what my program's for. Anyway.
Just.
Me too. No, Katie's great. I'm going to tell you, Katie and I were in a conference in California, and we were there for like 2 or 3 days. We had a great time. We really did. But I can tell you some things about Katie. Yeah. And unless she pays me, I will. No, she's great. Anyway, you know, my job is to share my experience, strength, and hope, tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I'm going to do that to the best of my ability. Here's what I can tell you, is that I know that you did not come here to hear me. I know you think that you came here to hear me, but you didn't. What you came here to hear is the message that my God of my understanding is going to give to you, and I'm just the vessel for that. I am only here. In body only, because everything else is his message. And I got an idea of what it's going to be, but sometimes I'm surprised myself. So we're not really sure. I also want to thank Julie and Jason. Julie and Jason, we met them last year at the Rogue Valley Roundup, and they picked us up from the airport, and they have taken care of us. And you know, they've been really, really sweet. Julie is just adorable. I just love her, and we've become fast friends. And Jason's like the little brother I never wanted. And it's been... he's just, if he can embarrass or humiliate me, he's got a good day going. So anyway, okay, here's what I can tell you. I did not grow up in an alcoholic home, and my parents were not alcoholics. And when I was born, I had two older sisters and an older brother waiting on me. My brother is 6 years older than me. He has been in prison three times, and he has been in and out of jail more times than I can count. All of it can be related back to drugs and alcohol. I've got a sister that is 10 years older than me, and she is an alcoholic, and she just celebrated 6 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got an older sister who is 11 years older than me, and she has drank or done a drug of some sort of some kind for as long as I can remember. And she does not think that she has a problem. I don't know if she's an alcoholic or not. She gives a good impression. And she says she does not need to drink. She just does it because she likes the way it makes her feel. Duh. And then there's me. And I have never drank or done a drug in my entire life. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Obviously, you don't know me. You know, you say that in a group of alcoholics, they look at you like you got a third eye. You say that out in the real world, and they do that. They go, oh, that's so great. Oh, that's really proud of you. You say that in a group of Al-Anons, they go, she is really sick. And they would be right. And the reason why I didn't drink or drug is because I thought that if I didn't drink or drug, that I wouldn't be like them, like my sisters and my brothers. You see, even at a young age, I made a conscious decision to do something, and I thought I was in control. I thought I could control it. You see, if I don't drink or drug, then I can't be affected by the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know what the disease of alcoholism was. I didn't know that that was what I was trying to do, but that's really what it was. I was trying to control it. I thought I could, if I didn't drink it, didn't inhale, didn't do whatever, I could not be affected. And boy, was that wrong. But I didn't know that at the time. I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and we grew up on 10 acres on a farm. My daddy was the hardest working man I've ever met. He would get up in the mornings, and he would go milk the cows and feed the cattle, and he would tend to whatever needed to be tended to. He would come in, he would get ready to go to work at Tinkerfield Air Force Base, and he'd work till that afternoon, and he would come home. He would tend to the garden, he would tend to the cows. He would come back in, he would eat dinner, and then he was a mechanic, and he would work on everybody in the neighborhood's car until dark. And then he would come in, he would watch TV, watch the news, and he would take a shower and go to bed. And he'd do the same thing all over again. He had an unbelievable work ethic, which he did pass on. And then my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And she was a school teacher. My daddy was the deacon for the Trinity Bible Baptist Church of Oklahoma, in Oklahoma, Choctaw, Oklahoma. He started that church. He was not a minister, but he was the song leader and a director. And we went to church every time the doors were open. We went Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, anytime there was any kind of fellowship, any kind of anything, we were there. We lived in this small town. Everybody knew us. We knew everybody. And I loved my life. And I had a great, great life growing up until I was about 8 years old. And my parents divorced when I was about seven, actually. And when my parents divorced, my brother went to go live with my dad. My eldest sister was married by that time. And me and my other sister went to live with my mom. And they moved us to a suburb of Oklahoma City. And it was Moore, Oklahoma. And if anybody knows anybody from Moore, Oklahoma, I apologize. I hated Moore. And it wasn't because of anything that happened in Moore or with Moore, the city. It was just the first time that kids were mean to me in my whole life. And they were cruel to me. Now listen, they had a lot to work with. I'll tell you why. I was the ugliest kid in school. Absolutely the ugliest kid in school. If you do not believe me, my husband is here. He has pictures on his phone. He will be happy to show you. But let me just give you an idea. Give you a little visual here. I had buck teeth, and then I had my baby teeth wouldn't fall out, so I had the vampire teeth that came out through the gums, so I looked like a vampire bunny. And then I had a big nose. It was my daddy's nose. When I went to go get it fixed when I was in my 20s, my plastic surgeon said, oh, your nose would look better on a man. And it did. It was my daddy's nose. Looked great on him, not so much on me. I had big, thick glasses because I could not see this far in front of my face. I was a tomboy. I was not very hygienic. I had long, stringy hair, and you usually saw me in hand-me-down clothes. And so kids were mean to me, and they did what kids do. They called me names, and they threw things at me and tripped me in the hall and all that kind of stuff. And you know what that taught me? If you're going to hurt me, you're not going to. to get close to me. And so I just kept you at a distance. And that's what I did. I isolated at a young age before I even knew what isolation was. I was a latchkey kid, and I just would come home from school, and I would come in and watch TV or read books or do whatever. My parents, I told you, were divorced. My mom did not take the divorce very well. And she went out and started partying at a young age, or when I was young. I was about, like I said, 7 years old. And at first, it was no big deal. It was every other weekend when I was at my dad's, or every other weekend when my brother would be come over. And then it would be, you know, both nights on the weekends. And then it would be every weekend. And yeah, eventually, it just became more and more and more. And what I can tell you is that I learned to take care of myself and be at home alone a lot when I was young. And by the time that I was 11 years old, my mother would leave on a Friday night to go out, and I would not hear from her again until Monday morning, when she would call me and tell me to get ready to go to school. And that's just the way it was in my home. And I'm going to tell you, I didn't think anything about that. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't know that there was anything not normal about that. I just thought that's what happened when parents divorced. Now, at my dad's house, it was different. I would go over to my dad's house, and it was just different. And I love my dad. I'm just going to tell you, I am a daddy's girl. I've always been a daddy's girl. And I just loved spending time with my dad no matter what. And so I would always go to my dad's house. And when I was 13, both of my parents remarried. My dad had been dating this lady for about 7 years, and I hated her. And she didn't do anything. I just hated her. And my mom married this man, and he became my stepdad. And he was really strict. And you know, I'm going to tell you, I needed that in my life, because I had been able to do whatever I wanted to do at my mom's house for a long, long time, because there was nobody there to tell me no. And I remember being out at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning at 10, 11 years old on the main streets in Oklahoma City and Del City area, and in places that I just didn't have any business being in. And it's just by the grace of God that something didn't happen to me. And I'd be on those streets at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and all I had to do was beat my mom home. That was really the only thing that I had to do. And so she married this guy, and he was strict, and he wanted to be the parent, which was a problem for me, because I had kind of taken that role over. But he was real strict, and I needed that. We had some. I had boundaries and rules, and for the first time in my life, and he did a lot of good things for me, and I need you to hear that, because he turned out not to be such a nice guy, but he was responsible for getting me braces and getting me contacts, and because he knew I was going to get ridiculed at school if we didn't get our fix, is basically what he was thinking. And he did a lot of good things for me. But we had a lot of struggles too. And so what eventually happened was, when I was 16 years old, I caught him getting up on the roof of the house and watching me take showers through the skylight. And you know, I'm going to just tell you, I work with a lot of girls who have been through abuse and have had stuff like that happen. And I'm just going to tell you, something happens to you when you're a girl and somebody does something that you lose your trust, that somebody that's supposed to love you and protect you, when something like that happens, something happens to you. It just does. And once again, if you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And so my daddy, I moved in with my daddy. And I got kicked out of the house right after that. After I caught him, and my mom stayed with that man. He kicked me out of the house, and I went to go live with my daddy, which was just fine with me. Thank you very much, because I love my daddy. But the problem was, my daddy was sick at the time, and he has a kidney disease that runs through our family, and I have it. My sister has it. I have nephews that have it. He was on dialysis at that time, and he was really sick, and he was dying. Now, that woman that I hated that he had married, she had gone to class and nursing school so that she could learn to put my daddy on a dialysis machine at home, so he wouldn't have to drive 3 times a week to the city. She would get up in the mornings, and she would cook his breakfast, and she would clean the house, clean up after breakfast, and she would get upstairs and she'd get ready for work, and she'd come home from work, she'd fix my daddy dinner. She would put him on a dialysis machine. She would clean up the house. She would go do the yard work. She'd do whatever needed to be done around the house, the laundry, whatever. And then she'd come in. She'd take my daddy off the dialysis machine, and she'd put him to bed. And she did that for years while my daddy was sick. I can't ever repay that woman for the love that she gave to my daddy. But he was dying. It was my senior year in high school. And I did what I always did. If you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. So I stayed real busy. I stayed real busy in school. I stayed real active. And I didn't spend a whole lot of time with my dad because I was scared. Once again, I was trying to control. I thought, if I don't get too close to him, it won't hurt so bad when he dies. That's really what I thought. And my senior year, the week of my graduation, my dad got a kidney transplant from his twin sister and saved his life. And he and I became really close then. And we spent a lot of time together, and we had a lot of good conversations, and we did a lot of things together. And I graduated from high school. I got a job right down the street. And about a year later, I met a guy. And I was 19, and I knew him 2 months, and he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And we got married 4 months later. My dad hated him. I would love to tell you that the reason why we got married and I said yes is because we were in love and I just knew that this was the man of my dreams. I did it because he's asked, and I thought, if I don't say yes, I am never going to get married. I'll never have another chance. Now, that's the truth. I just thought this was my only shot. So we got married. I instantly knew it was the biggest mistake of my life. Now, let me tell you something. When I grew up, all my sisters and brothers were screw-ups, frankly, and so I was going to be the good kid. And so I could not admit when I was wrong. And so there's a, on page 62 in Hope for Today, it talks about taking on the characteristics of their father. And it talks about how that those were learned behaviors. And I'm going to tell you, I learned that from my stepdad. My stepdad never admitted he was right. He never apologized. And I'm going to tell you, that is something that I took on. That is a character defect that I carried through. And so I am married. I am miserable, but everything's right, all right here. And I just keep going through the motions. And because I can't admit that I've made a mistake. I just can't. And I just keep thinking I'm going to make this work. And we stayed married for about 8 years, and about 4 years into it, we had a little boy. And he became the only reason I came home at night. And I loved that little boy, and but I was miserable in that marriage. And so I was working at a bank in Oklahoma City, and I was driving back and forth to work, and I was looking for a way out of my marriage. And he walked in the door, and he was the best looking thing I'd ever seen. He had beautiful blue eyes, and he had this dark hair, and he was always perfect teeth, and he was dressed to the nines, and he was the attorney for the bank. He was on the board of directors. He was on my loan approval committee, and every time that he would walk in the door, all the girls would giggle, and all the guys would slap him on the back and shake his hand, and he just lit up. Everybody in the place just focused on him, and I was a nervous wreck. I would shake. I couldn't even form a sentence, and that never happened before. I would run from him, and he was the attorney for the bank, and one day he asked me to bring a file down to his office, and he took me to lunch, and that was it. And I started dating him, and I left my husband. And I need you to hear that. I started dating him, and then I left my husband. And the reason why you need to hear that is because I lied about that to a lot of people for a lot of years. And because I can always make myself look a lot better than I am. So I would say stuff like this: oh, we were separated before I started dating him. And we were separated. I was in the kitchen, he was in the garage. Or I would say, our marriage was over long before I started dating him. And it was, he just did not know that. And so those are the things that I would say. That's exactly how I would rationalize anything. I can always make it sound better than it is. And that's just the truth. That's the way I always was. And so we had this horrible, horrible divorce with this huge custody battle. He got custody of our son. I was devastated. I just could not believe it. How could God let this happen? I mean, it was just not good. And so, but, you know, I meet this guy. He is a lot of fun. I mean, he was not like anybody I'd ever been around in my life. We had so much fun. We could have fun watching TV or going to the movies or going to dinner or just talking on the phone. We had a blast. He didn't care what anybody thought. He didn't care what he'd say anything to anybody. He didn't care what anybody what their response was. He just didn't care, and I was just amazed by that. Sometimes I was embarrassed by that, but mostly I was amazed by that. And we start dating, and I noticed that he doesn't sleep a lot. like for days at a time. And I cannot figure that out. And so I ask him one day, I go, how come you don't sleep for days at a time? And he said, oh, I have a sleeping disorder. I've had it since college. And I believed him. So I had to fix him. So, I do what any normal person would do in my situation. I move in with him because you got to keep an eye on him 24/7. He's drinking too much coffee, he's staying up too late, something is going on, and I'm going to figure it out. That's what I do. And so I move in with him. It doesn't get any better. It actually gets worse. And we get into some horrible, horrible fights in our house. Horrible. And I have a stepdaughter, his daughter, and she was about 5 when I met him, and our kids are at our house on the weekends. And I'm going to tell you something. They have seen some horrific things. They have heard us call each other names that I would not call my worst enemy today, and that's the truth. They have seen things that nobody should have to see with their parents. That's just the truth. It was ugly in our house. I can't figure out what's going on with him, and I'm trying to figure it out, and he gets really jealous and paranoid, and I, of course, what we think. That just means he loves me. And when I started dating him, I'm going to tell you, there were some people that knew him and knew me, and they would call me up and they'd say, is it true that you are dating Cliff Gooding? And I'd say, yeah, why, do you know him? And they go, oh yeah. And I'd say, well, tell me what you think about him. And they go, well, he's really smart. He's one of the smartest men you'll ever meet, and he's a brilliant attorney. And he is. He's graduated top 5% in his law class. He did his undergraduate in 3 years, whatever. And I didn't go to college either, Katie. And so, and they said, and he's extremely successful. He's a brilliant attorney. He's really, really great. And then they'd say, and he's a lot of fun, he's the life of the party. And then they'd say something along these lines, but he's a liar, he's a cheat, he's a womanizer. You can't trust him as far as you can throw him. You really, really need to stay away from him. That's what they said. What I heard was, he needs you. It's kind of crazy. I'm trying to figure out what's going on with him, and he's really paranoid and jealous. And so I knew he loved me, so I married him because that's going to make it better. And we get married, and it just gets worse. It just gets worse. That's all that I can tell you. It just gets worse. And we start going to a counselor. And the first time that I'd never been to a counselor, first time I went to this counselor, she has this little intake sheet that you fill out, and they ask you these questions, and there's something like, do you drink more than 3 drinks at a time? Do you smoke marijuana? Have you ever taken illegal drugs? Do you abuse prescription drugs? Have you ever had more than 1 sexual partner at a time? I was appalled. How dare you? Do you not know who I am? So I'm filling this out, checking no. And so she comes out and she grabs this thing from me and she says, okay, I'm going to look at this. Give me about 10 minutes. And I'm going to come back out and we're going to talk. And I said, okay. I swear, it did not seem like she had barely shut the door before she had turned her out back around and opened that door. And she goes, well, looks like the only thing sick about you is that you're dating Cliff Gooding. Let's talk about that. True story. Now, let me tell you what I heard. That's what she said. You know what I heard? See, you're not the problem. He is. You're fine. This is about him. There's something wrong with him. Now, that's what I heard. So we go to counseling for a while. It seems to kind of get better in spurts, but really it just one thing after the other. He didn't go to work half the time. It was just ugly, ugly, ugly. And finally, our counselor sends us over to a psychiatrist or psychologist or alert. I don't know what she was, but she was brilliant. She was actually in the program of Al-Anon, and I did not know it. And she figured him out really quickly. And one day she says to me, he had been up for another 3 days, and, you know, we'd had another knockdown drag out, and I was just about done. I could not handle much more. And she said, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to write you a prescription for tranquilizers. I want you to give him one at 6 o'clock, and if he's not asleep by 10, give him another one. But then you just go to bed and leave him alone. And I said, okay. And so that's what I did. And the next morning, we were supposed to go get our daughter from camp, and I got up and walked, and he was not in bed with me, which I'm going to tell you was not an uncommon occurrence at that time. And I got up and I walked across the house, and I went over to we have a mother-in-law plan, and I went over to the other side of the house, and I went to open the door to the spare bedroom, and it was barricaded, and that was new. That had not happened before, which is no trick for an Al-Anon, just so you'll know. We just barge right in that sucker. And so we get in the room, and I get in the room, and he's passed out. And he's passed out, and there's a bottle of wine, an empty bottle of wine on the floor, and another bottle of vodka or something. I can't even remember. And then pulled up next to him is a TV where the white screen where the adult videos had ran out, and a little white package of something powdery. And that's how I found him. And I'm going to tell you, he's still the best-looking man I've ever seen. I still love him with all my heart, but at that time, at that day, it was the most disgusting I'd ever felt towards a man. That's just the truth. I was disgusted. And I hit him as hard as I could hit him. My object was to hit him so hard that he would roll over and hit his head on the end table. And I hit him as hard as I could hit him. He bolted straight out of bed, and I picked up that package of cocaine, and I shook it in his face, and I said, "What the hell is this?" And he looked up at me, and his eyes got real big, and he goes, "I don't know." Needless to say, we had a little discussion. He left. He went to go get to pick up his daughter from camp. He came back a few hours later, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I live here." And I go, "Not today, you don't. You're not staying here." And he said, "Well, I don't have anywhere to go." And I said, "I don't really care." He said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" Now, I said, "I want you to go tell Wilma what you've been doing." Now, Wilma is our daughter's mother. And I'd love to tell you, and at the time, I think she had like 13 or 14 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I said, "You're going to go tell her what you've been doing." And he said, "Okay." And he left. And a couple hours later, he came back. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I live here." And I said, "Not today, you don't. Obviously, you've forgotten this conversation." And he said, "Well, I did what you said. I went and told Wilma what was going on, and I went to a meeting, and I'm going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I had no idea what he was talking about, nor did I care. All I cared is that you're not staying in this house. So he left again, and I called Wilma. Now, I would love to tell you that I called Wilma because I needed a solution. I needed help. I called Wilma to check up on him. That's why I called. And so she said, "Yes, he told me what was going on, and we went to a meeting, and he's going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, "Yeah." I go, "He told me all that." I go, "What do I do?" And she said, "Would you be willing to go to a meeting with me tomorrow?" And for some reason, I said, "Sure." I don't know how you got to Al-Anon. I got here with the ex-wife. She took me to my first meeting. She took me to my second meeting. And I'm forever grateful to that woman. She introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. I am so forever grateful to that woman. And so I started going to meetings, and I start learning about now listen, I didn't come to Al-Anon because I thought there was a problem with me and I needed help. I came to Al-Anon to get him sober. That's why I came to Al-Anon, and I think there's a lot of us that do that. We don't come in here with pure motives, I'm just going to tell you. But I did. I started going to meetings, and about 45 days later, he relapsed. And I didn't know what to do, and I called Wilma again, and she said, "Would you be willing to go with me to see an attorney? Because I think we need to have supervised visitation with our children with him." And I said, "Sure." And so we went over, and met this attorney, who was also in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she asked me, she said, "Do you want a divorce?" And I said, "No." I said, "I know how to do a divorce. I've done that before." And she said, "Well, tell me what you want." I said, "You know, I just want him to be okay. I just want him to get better." She said, "If that's true, You need to set some boundaries. You need to figure out what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And you need to go and you need to confront him and talk to him. But you've got to be calm. You've got to be calm when you talk to him. Now I'm just going to tell you, there are 1,000 adjectives that can describe me. Calm is not going to make the list. Never been calm, doesn't know what calm was. I'm going to tell you, if you saw what happened inside our home, you would not go, oh, she's so calm. I'm just telling you, when I tell you we had horrible, horrible fights, Cliff is not a physical person. He's not violent in the least, but you put drugs and alcohol in a person, you never know what you're going to get. And one time we had a huge row, and he was dragging me down the hall by my hair, and I was kicking and fighting and screaming, and it was ugly. And my son walked out of his bedroom door, and the best answer I had for him was, go back in your room. Go back in your room. You see, that's the kind of parent I am without you guys. That's who I was when I got here. He was scared to death, bawling, and my answer was, go back in your room. Do not tell me that this is not a family disease. Do not tell me that. Because I'm telling you right now, it affects everybody. Everybody. So, anyway, I start going, I drive around that day, and the only thing after 45 days of meetings, the only thing I knew was a serenity prayer. That was it. And so what I did is I drove around all day long and said the serenity prayer. And if I said it once, I said it 1,000 times. And I just drove around. I had a really good job at the time, which was good because I had been supporting this for about 3 years because he had not been working. And I had the flexibility to do that. And I came home, I called him and I said, would you meet me at home tonight? And he said, sure. And when I got in, I walked in, and he had his back to me, and he was on the computer and had the TV going in our son's room. And I said, would you turn around? And he did, and I took his hand, and I said this. And I don't know where this came from because it was not me. I said, you know, I know you have a problem, and I know you must be scared. And I love you. And I'll do my part. I'll do whatever I got to do for my part. If I have to go to meetings or counseling or treatment, whatever it is that I got to do my part, I'm willing to do that. But you got to be willing to do yours. And if you can't do that, I can't do this anymore. But I love you. And he said, you're right. And something happened right then and right there. I mean, something just happened right then and right there. And he got honest with me for the first time. And the next day, he got a sponsor, and he has been sober ever since. But that left me with me. And that wasn't good. And so, I was going to meetings, and finally, I had to get a sponsor. And let me just tell you this. If you want to feel better, you go to a meeting. If you want to get better, work the steps. I got a sponsor, and we started working the steps. And first time I called her, she said, well, tell me why you think you need Al-Anon. So I'll tell you what I did. I told him all about him. I told her all about him. He did this, and then he did this, and you wouldn't believe what I found out. And then did it, and I just went, la, 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 la. She just listened. She was really calm. She goes, huh, well, now we know he's not the problem. You are. It's the first time I really understood that I really was the problem. The reality was, whether he had gotten sober or not, had I not fixed me, there would have been another alcoholic coming along. That's just the truth. I'm attracted to alcoholics. I'm just going to tell you, I love alcoholics. I love them. They're smart. They're fun. They're exciting. I also love short men. I don't know what that's about either. I'm serious. My husband's 5'6". I've never gone for the tall guy. If you're short, I'm going to like you. If you're alcoholic and short, I'm going to love you. It is true. But when she said that, now listen, we started working the steps, and I realized that I was powerless. I mean, I came in here desperate. I didn't have any other ideas. If I would have had another idea, if I would have had another trick in the book, I'd have tried it. I was out. I had tried everything. And so we figured out that I was powerless in step one, and that my life was unmanageable. And then we went in through this to the next step. And let me just tell you about the insanity part. Let me tell you what my day was like. I would get up in the morning and I would wake him up and I would say, get up, get up, get up. You've got to go to work today. He'd say, okay, and he'd get up. I'd leave and I'd go to my meeting in the first thing in the morning. After my meeting, I would call him and he would not answer his phone, which is so irritating. So I'd call the cell phone, I'd call the house phone, I'd call the cell phone. He would not answer. So I'd get in my car, I'd drive back to the house, I would go in, he'd be still asleep in bed. I'd get up. We got to go to work today. You've got to get up. I would not leave until he was out of the shower, dressed, and on the road. I would go back to my work. I would work for a little while. I would call his office at noon, and they would say, he is here, but he is not answering his phone, and he has shut his office door, and we can't get him to answer. I would get in my car, I would drive down to his office. I would go up to his deal. I would knock on his office door. I'd say, Cliff, it's me. Open the door. He would let me in. I'd say, you've got to work. They have phone calls for you. They've got people here to meet. You've got to work. He'd say, okay. I'd get in my car. I'd go back down to the office. I'd work for a few days, 5 hours. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd call and they'd say, he's gone for the day. And I'd finish out my day and I'd go home and I'd say, why did you go home? And he'd say, I was done. The next morning, I'd get up and I'd say, get up. We have to go to work today. Now, I'm going to tell you, I did that over and over and over again. And every time that I did that, every single time, I thought, this time it's going to work. This time he's going to do what I want him to do. This time he's going to behave. That happened to me over and over again. I'm going to tell you, I've tried it all. I've tried guilt, manipulation, fear. I've tried it all to get them to act the way that they need to act. I've tried it all. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. We are powerless. And keeping trying and doing it over and over again is the insanity of it. I told you that I went to church with my daddy. I mean, we went to church all the time. And as a matter of fact, when the divorce happened with my parents, I was the only one that still continued to go to church. And so I really always believed in God. I always believed in God. I really didn't think that was going to be a big deal for me. But what I found out is that I never trusted him. Now, if you would have asked me that, I'd have passed any lie detector test. If you would have asked me if I trusted God, I would have said yes, and I would have passed. The truth of the matter was, when I started working through step 3, I realized I did not trust God. Because if I would have trusted God, I would have been able to leave things with him and never give it another thought, never try to control it again, never try to take it back. I never did that. I always tried to work it out my way. Because I was scared to death. What if it didn't turn out the way I wanted it? What would happen if it's not going to work out this way? What would I do? I did it over and over again. I found out that I had to figure out who God was going to be for me. And it wasn't that God that I learned in church. Now I'm going to tell you. I heard about God, and I was scared to death of God. He was up there taking names. He was writing down everything that I did wrong, and one of these days I was going to have to answer to him. That's what I thought. Now, let me tell you something. I'm sure they talked about a loving, kind, generous God in church. I didn't hear that. I know that that's not the church's fault. That's just not what I heard. It's just not what I heard. So I had to figure out who God was going to be to me. And that idea has changed, and it still changes. It changes sometimes daily, sometimes monthly, sometimes yearly. I don't know, but it constantly evolves for me. But I don't have to completely understand him, but I know that today I can trust him. I trust him. We did my fourth step, and I wrote my fourth step out, and it was probably the first time in my whole life I was totally honest with myself. I'm going to tell you, I'd lied to a lot of people a lot of years, but the person I'd lied to the most was me. And it was the first time I was completely honest with myself, and I started looking at every part that I played. Along this time, our daughter, she was about 13 at the time, we had remodeled her and my son's room. And we had done everything. We'd painted and got new furniture, and about the only thing left to do was get drapes and some bedding and some other stuff. And it was spring break or fall break or something. I don't even remember, but I was at work, and it was on a Friday, and my husband was home with our daughter, and he called me up, and he said, hey, he goes, today me and Rachel went and got our bedding. And my first thought was, how dare you? How dare you? How dare you do that without me? And so I said, okay. And so I get home, and I said, well, show me what you got. And so they did. They showed me what they got, and I said, you know what? This doesn't even match her room. And I said, and this material is way too thin, and she's going to tear it up. And I said, and you spent way too much money on this. What were you thinking? You know, and he was just trying to do the right thing. He was really just trying to give me a break and go take care of something. And he said, I'm sorry, you know, I just thought I'd help. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And so the next day I took the stuff and I threw it in the trunk of my car and I went and did my fifth step. And I started doing my fifth step with my sponsor and we get about halfway through it. And she goes, okay. She goes, well, it's going to take a little break here. She goes, I'm going to go get something to drink, go to the bathroom. Do you need anything? I said, no. And she came back and she said, now listen, before we get started on this fifth step again, she goes, is there anything else that you might need to tell me that's outside of this fifth step? Now, I don't know why she stopped and asked me that. I have no idea, but she did. And I go, oh, yeah, I kind of got to tell you what I did yesterday. And so I start telling her about what I did, how I threw a fit about this. And she goes, well, do you know what you did when you did that? And I said, yes, once again, I was controlling and had to have my own way. She said, no, that's not what you did. She said, when you told her that that didn't match her room, you told her that her opinion did not matter. And when you told her that the material was too thin and she was going to tear it up, you told her that no matter what she did for the rest of her life, you were always going to know better than her. And when you told her it was too expensive, you told her she wasn't worth it. Those are the exact nature of my wrongs. It's not the big stuff. I can see the big stuff. It's those cutting, biting things that I do to everybody every single day of my life that I've done. Making you feel less than. Tearing you apart without even thinking about it. Without even giving a pause to what is coming out of my mouth. I felt horrible. I felt horrible. But you know what she did? She said, we're going to go back through your fifth step and we're going to identify the exact nature of your wrongs. And that's what we did. When I got done, I went home and I apologized to my daughter. And I told her what I did and I told her how I affected her and I was so sorry. And I said, is there anything that I can do to make it up to you? And she said, I didn't really want that anyway. But I said, you know what? We're going to go pick you out whatever you want. You pick out whatever you want. And we did that. She cried, I cried, it was great. And so, now listen, 6 and 7, that's where my character defects are, and that's where I've got to make some changes. That's where I've got to know that I got to know what those character defects are, and I'd already told you about a few that I had earlier, and I've got to be aware of those. I've got to be aware of those in order to change them. And I can't change them. I can't do anything about it, but I got to let him work in my life and allow him to bring them up to me, let me be noticed and mindful of them so that I can take the action. And my daddy died a month before I got in this program. And he never got to see me in recovery, and he never got to see Al-Anon or AA work in our lives. But God, in his wisdom, was working in my life all long time before I ever got in this program. And he was the one person in my life that was not on my 8-step list, because Daddy and I were close, and we had said everything that needed to be said. My daddy was sick for a long time. And before he died, and I spent a lot of time with my dad, and I was a good daughter to my dad, and I am so grateful for that, because God was working in my life before I ever got in this program, and he saw fit that I didn't have to make amends to my dad, and I am so grateful for that. But there was a lot of other people on there, and that mom that I told you about that left me at home a lot and stayed with that man. I had a few little resentments towards her, and you know, here's what I know about that, is that my mom did the best that she could do. My mom can't give to me what she didn't get herself, and she didn't have the best childhood herself. And I had to learn to forgive that woman. My sponsor said, you've been asking for apples from your mama your whole life, and all she's got is oranges. So either learn to love oranges or accept what she's got. Leave it alone. And she was right. My mom and I, we've had several conversations, but one of the best ones we had is we talked about my growing up and what she had done, and she said, I have cried myself to sleep so many times over the way that I treated you. And I said, well, Mom, you need to forgive yourself, because I've forgiven you a long time ago, and we're okay. Mom and I will never have the relationship of a mother-daughter baking cookies and spending time together. That's just not who she is, and that's just not how our relationship is. But we do the best with what we have today. And she's 83 years old. I talk to her on a regular basis. I don't have any animosity to her. And we worked everything out. She did what she did the best she could at the time. And, I have to accept that. My stepdad actually had passed away before that. And, I wrote a letter to him. And I wrote a letter to him about all the things that he did for me. Now, that didn't mean that it was okay for him getting on the roof of the house and watching me take showers. That's not what that meant. But I forgave him because I now know that he was probably an alcoholic. When I told my sponsor about him, she said, well, do you think he was an alcoholic? And I go, no. And she goes, well, did he drink? I go, oh, yeah, he drank every day. She said, well, tell me about that. And I said, well, he would go by in Texas and buy beer because it's stronger there and bring it to Oklahoma, cases of it at a time. And I said, he drank beer like, I drink water or you guys drink pop or whatever. And I said, and then every night he'd have an Ezra Brooks and Coke, at least one, maybe two. She goes, well, why do you think he wasn't an alcoholic? And I said, well, I never saw him drunk. She goes, how do you know you never saw him sober? Never crossed my mind. That he probably was an alcoholic, and I forgave him. I could look at him with compassion, as a sick person, and I honestly, when I think of that man, I never think of anything bad. I really don't. The only time I think of him is when I'm up here talking. When I ever think about anything else that happened to him, with him, that stepmom of mine, I hated her for so long. But what happened was she became the mother that I always wanted. She was really, really good to me. Really good to me. After my daddy died, I was always at their house every Wednesday night. My son and I would go over there for dinner every Wednesday night. And she asked me after my dad died. Are you still going to do dinner this next Wednesday? And she said, yeah. Are you still coming? And I said, well, of course. She goes, I was so afraid that you wouldn't come after your daddy died. And she was a good woman. She's a good woman. She and she and I remain close. I saw her all the time, and I talked to her all the time. And after a couple of years, she met this man. His name's Herschel, and he's the sweetest man. And he's like 5'6". My stepmom is a tall woman. She's like 5'10". Yeah, she's tall. He's short. It's great. Anyway, she said, I've met this guy, and I want you to meet him. And then she said, but he's kind of short. I go, you may not notice this, Mom, but I kind of like short guys. And anyway, he's the sweetest man. I mean, he's just the sweetest man. And so I had taken her to New York one year, and on a vacation. It was like her Mother's Day and a birthday present. And we were walking. She said, I never thought that you'd get married again, but I could kind of see you marrying Herschel. She goes, I could too. And that was like in May. And then in June, she called me and she said, hey, I need to talk to you about something. And I said, you're getting married, aren't you? And she said, well, not if you're not ready. She said, I know how much your daddy meant to you, and if you're not ready for this, I don't have to do this right now. And I said, oh, Mom, don't you ever give me that much power. And and I said, you know what? My daddy would want you to be happy, and he would not want you to be alone. And so they got married, and I'm really grateful for Herschel. And 2012 was one of the suckiest years of my life. No butterflies out the butt. Anyway, in 2011, about November, late November, early December, my husband and I had some issues. And He didn't cheat on me. He didn't relapse. He didn't do any of those major things that you would think would happen. He didn't have any kind of addiction. But his ego was out of control, and he was getting sick right in the middle of AA. That's just the truth. And his ego was so out of control that I could not stand to be around him, and I told him that he couldn't come home one night. And I'm going to tell you, at 11-plus years of sobriety and recovery, to kick your husband out of the house is not an easy thing to do. But I did. And the reason why I did that is because my boundaries and my values today are totally different than when I came in this room. There's like a lot of women that would never even give it a thought about kicking their husband out of the house for some of the stuff that he did. But today, there's stuff that I won't deal with. I have been taught that we do not accept unacceptable behavior and that we teach people how to treat us. And so, it was hard. It was not an easy thing to do. He went and worked on some stuff, and he was out of the house for a little over a month. And then one day I called him and I said, are you ready to come home? He was like, yeah. And he did. He came home. And the next day, we were at two. Now listen, I know we got three speakers from Texas here. I'm from Oklahoma. I am not an OU fan. I'm an Oklahoma State girl. But you know, I was wondering, why do you have three Texans and only one Okie? And then I realized it's going to take three Texans to equal one Okie. So I was okay. Sorry. I'm kidding. I love Texas. My husband was born in Texas. I swear. I'm just totally kidding. I love Texas. I really do. That's where we go to shop. Anyway, it's true. And so, where was I? Okay, so the next day we were going to go to the Oklahoma State basketball game. And I had gotten up early with my friends to run that morning. And we ran about 6 miles. And then I came home and, yeah, I don't do that anymore. And some sanity has returned to my life. And so, we went to the game and I came home and I was exhausted. And I said, and we were going to dinner and a meeting that night. And I said, honey, just give me about 15 minutes and I'm going to lay down for a little bit and then we'll go. And he said, okay. And so I laid down and my phone rang and it was Herschel. And my stepmom had had some problems a couple months before. She had some trouble breathing, and she had went to the emergency room, and she had organized pneumonia in her lungs, and then they found cancer under her armpit, and they took it out. It was no big deal, but she had been going back and forth to the hospital here lately, and she had just been in the hospital, and the Monday before I'd went and seen her at the hospital, and my home group meets on Monday nights at 5:30, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon I went to go see her. And she was on oxygen, and she seemed to be doing just fine. And I sat there and talked to her for about an hour and a half, and I said, I'm going to go. I need to go to my meeting. And she loved. She'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. She did come to hear me speak one time, but she loved Alcoholics Anonymous because she'd seen the changes that you guys had made in Cliff, and she had seen what Al-Anon had done for me. And I said, I need to go to my meeting, and she said, what she said to me every time that I pretty much saw her, she'd say, don't forget, I love you. And I'd say, I know, I love you too. She goes, you remember that? I go, I will. And so I went to my home group, and so we go to the basketball game. I come home, and Herschel calls, and he said, your mom is gone. And I did not expect that, I'm just going to say. And he said, I need you to come up to the hospital and say goodbye. And Cliff called some of my sponsees and some members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my sponsees, her husband is also a sponsee of my husband's, and when we pulled up to the hospital, they were waiting on us. And his name is Jay and her name is Darlette. And when I got out of the car to walk up to the steps, Jay was right there and he just held out his hands and I just fell apart in his arms. And they took me up to tell my mama goodbye. The next day I went to the house to talk to Herschel because we were going to make arrangements. And at the end of my mom's life that last week, she was really having a hard time getting up and down the stairs. and she insisted on sleeping in her own bed upstairs. And what would happen is by the time that she would get to the top of the stairs, she would be so exhausted, she'd just fall into bed. And so Herschel had bought her a chairlift. And so the next day, we're sitting around, we're waiting for my brothers and sisters to get there, and I said, Herschel, how much did that chairlift cost you? It had gotten installed the day before she went to the hospital. And he said, something like $2,700 or something. And I said, and she got to use it one time. And he goes, it was worth it. For all the pain I've caused, for everything that has happened to me, for all the bad decisions and everything that's gone on in my life, if it got me to you, it was worth it. That 10th step is really important to me. I'm going to tell you, I used to be able to justify anything that I did. Now, it's not that easy. And, as soon as something comes out of my mouth, I know it in my pit of my stomach. I got to make it right, or I won't be able to eat, sleep, or anything. That's just the truth. I have a conscience today. And the 11th step is where I grow closer to my God. I love prayer and meditation today. I didn't think I'd ever say that, but I do. I'd said a lot of prayers in my life, but I don't think I'd really pray till I got to you. And the 12th step is really important to me. And, here's my little soapbox. you can carry the message in a million ways. You can do it by sponsoring people. You can do it by being at a podium. You can do it by sharing in a meeting. You can be on any kind of AA or Al-Anon board or whatever. And that's really important. Service is a huge part. But the last part of that 12 step says, well, for us it says, first of all, we carry the message to others, not alcoholics, not good for us. But it says we practice these principles in all our affairs. That means all our affairs. That means that I can get up here and sound really great and wonderful, but if I get in the room and start cussing out my husband, I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. If I go to the doctor and he says, hey, you need to start eating better, you need to chill out a little bit, and then when I go and I sit down and I eat like I'm going the electric chair, not practicing these principles in all my affairs. That means if I buy things that I can't afford, I am not practicing the principles in all my affairs. In all our affairs, it's not just about in these rooms. It's not just about with alcoholism or the disease of alcoholism or relationships. It's in everything. Another thing. Here's what happened in 2012. January, my mama died. In February, we had a family tragedy where my niece and great niece were murdered by my niece's husband, and then he killed himself. In March, we had like 3 weeks' notice to move all of our law offices from one office to another. It was a big mess. It just seemed like there was something every single month that was happening to me. And in April, my son totaled his truck, and he was fine. But when I got the insurance money, I said, here's the insurance money. This is how much you have to spend. Go buy you a new truck, and I'll pay for it. And he just wanted me to give him the check, which was not happening. And he's not an alcoholic. I promise you he's going to marry one, but he is not an alcoholic. And but he got mad, and he didn't talk to me for 3 months. Now, this is a child I have talked to every week, if not every day, from the time he was born. And he did not talk to me for 3 months. Here's the other thing about that. Forgot to tell you about this little part. That ex-husband of mine, you can imagine the resentments I had with him. I got to tell him what a great job he did raising our son. I got to tell him how grateful I am for our son and that he was a good daddy. He almost fell out in the parking lot when I told him, but I did tell him. And he did. He did a great job raising our son. He really, really did. And when my son was, and I had fought several times to get custody of my son back, and I never did win. And when he was 18, he moved in with us. Without any kind of manipulation or anything of me doing, he just turned 18 and moved in with us. And then I was thinking, God, when's this kid moving out? And I'm kidding. Really, he's a good kid. Anyway, but he wouldn't talk to me. He didn't talk to me for 3 months. And at first I was texting and calling him, and he wouldn't return my calls, and he wouldn't text me. And, you know, I was really healthy. I was thinking, I pay for this phone. I'll shut that sucker off. You're not going to talk to me. And my sponsor said, no. She goes, you know, you just need to leave him alone. You don't get to call him or text him again. I thought she had lost her mind. I was like, are you crazy? She was like, no, just leave him alone. So for 3 months, I did not talk to my son, and it was about to kill me. And finally, after about 3 months, she said, have you heard from him yet? His name is Colby, by the way. And I said, no. I said, I haven't heard from him. She goes, okay, here's what you get to do. You get to go get a card, and the only thing it can say is that you love him and you miss him. That's it. You don't get to write in there, gee, I wish you'd call me. I really do miss you. I wish you'd come see me. Where have you been? Nothing like that. I love you and I miss you, Mom. That's it. So a couple weeks later, she said, have you got that card? And I said, no. She goes, you're going to get it this weekend. So I said, okay. So I got it, and I found this little cute little card. And you open it up, and on the inside it said, been thinking about you. And I wrote, and I love you and I miss you. Love, Mom. And at the time, I had I have a sponsee, and she, at the time, her best friend, husband, worked with my son. And so we were at our meeting on Monday night, and I handed her this card. I go, could you make sure that this card gets to Colby? And she said, sure. So the next day I'm at work, and about 10:30, Colby texts me. And he says, hey, Mom, I'm really sorry. I love you. I miss you, and I miss Cliff, and I'd really like to see you guys. You think we could go to dinner this week? And I was so excited, and I was like, yeah. So we made plans for dinner. And I called my sponsee, and I said, did you give Colby that give that card to him to give to Colby? She goes, nope, still in my car. You see, that's how God works in my life. All I got to do is take the action. All I got to do is follow some direction, and God takes care of the rest. About 4 or 5 years ago, we had this horrible, horrible hailstorm in Oklahoma City, and I had this little bitty Mercedes convertible that was my little toy. I just drove it on weekends and for fun. That my husband is an older one, and I just loved it, and it got completely totaled in the hailstorm. And I'm a car person. I don't know. Listen, you're either a car person or you're not. I got it from my daddy, and here's a good trick. If you're a car person, here's what it is. It's like you grow an attachment to your vehicle. I mean, you really like it. I mean, you know, you wash it all the time. It's not... It's a part of you. You love the cars. You just do. It's like a family member. If you're not a car member, it gets you from point one A to B. That's it. I'm a car person. I mean, I wash... My husband, not a car person. His idea of washing the car is it rains. And so... I like cried. I was like, my car's done. And Cliff's like, we'll just get you another one. I was like, you don't understand. It's not the same. And anyway, so it took me like, I couldn't decide what I wanted to get. It just took me a long, long time. And finally, I decided I was going to, I know this is going to sound stupid. I wanted the new four-door Jeeps. I just wanted one so bad. And Cliff's like, you're kidding me. And I was like, no, that's really what I want. So it took me another year to finally do it, because I get attached to cars. And so I get the car, and my dad loved country music. I grew up on country music, and I mean the classics. I mean Patsy Cline, Merle Haggard, George Jones, all that. Grew up on them. My daddy's favorite song was George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today. I'm just going to tell you, I hope you guys like that song. I hated it, but my daddy loved it, and I just hated that song. Anyway, I go to get this Jeep. I finally pick it out. It takes me a day or two to finally go get it, and I go to pick it up, and I'm looking at it because my daddy was a car guy, and I said, I wonder if my daddy would have liked this car. I bet he would have. Yeah, he may not have. I don't know. I start the car. He Stops Loving Her Today came on the radio. You can call that a coincidence. I call it God. And so, you know, God's just sometimes God shows up, and sometimes he shows out. And he shows out a lot in my life. He just does. And that daughter that I told you about, when we remodeled her room, she she started getting in trouble. God, probably 15, 16 years old. She's just like her daddy. She's smart. She's talented. She is a lot of fun to be around. But she's just like her daddy. And she was drinking and she was partying. And it was, we'd go months and almost years without seeing her. I didn't know where she was or what was going on with her a lot of the times. And I'm going to tell you, that's really hard. It's really hard. I'm going to tell you, the disease of alcoholism is horrible anyway. And it's horrible when it's a spouse or your parent or a sibling. I think it's 100 times worse when it's your kids. I just do. That's just my opinion, but I think it's 100 times worse when it's your kids. Because, you know, you're a parent and you're supposed to love and protect them and take care of them. And then you can't enable them. And it's just really hard. And I am so thankful for these programs. I'm so thankful for Al-Anon because we had to let go and let God. And there was months we didn't know where she was or what was going on with her. A few months back, she called. I was in my room and I had noticed I had 2 missed calls from her. And as I'm going to pick up the phone, her dad comes walking down the hall and he's talking to her on the phone. And I heard him talking to her and he hung up the phone and she had said, "Daddy, I need help. I can't stop." And he did what you're supposed to do. He said, "Honey, I can't help you, but I'll give you a number of a lady in AA and you can call her." And she did. Today, Rachel is 24 years old today and she has 83 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. 83 days. Happy birthday, Rachel. 83 days. Did I mention she has 83 days? 83 days. She, you know, I hope that next year when my husband comes to talk to you that he can tell you she has a little over a year, but I don't know because all I got is today. That's all I got is today. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for today. So grateful for today. 83 days. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you, Al-Anon. I'm so glad there was somebody there to answer the phone for her. I'm so glad that there was somebody to welcome her to a meeting, just like there was somebody to welcome me to my first meeting and take me to my first meeting and answer my phone calls. I so appreciate that. Everything that I have today, everything that I am today, is because of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything in my life, everything, is because of the God of my understanding, which you people gave to me. There is not anything that I have or that I am that is not a direct result of this program. Nothing. And so that's why I do this, because I've got to be able to give back just a little bit of what you've given so much for me. We had this couple back in Oklahoma City, and they were wonderful. Hody and Jack Mitchell, and they had, I think Hody had 36 years when she passed away, and I think Jack had 41 or something like that when he died. And Hody had this Mitchell, she had this prayer, and we call it the Hody Prayer. And she said it every time we'd circle up to do the Lord's Prayer, this is what she would say. And she taught it to a few of us, and I'm one of the ones that she taught it to, and I say it every time that I close my talk, and this is how it goes. I've been told that the reason why we join hands is to remind us of the truth, that we are no longer alone. Our prayers for the still suffering alcoholics in these rooms and on the streets. Hold on to the person's hand next to you like your life depends on it, because someday it may. Thank you for holding my hand and allowing me to hold yours.